Jeff Tall, and you are now tuned into KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial.
Hey, we're Los Lonely Boys, and you're listening to KBOO.
This is Rising Up with Son Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Son Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll turn to The Nation magazine's DC Bureau Chief Chris Layman for a preview of the upcoming midterm elections, which Senate and House seats to watch for, and which party appears likely to control Congress. Then we'll examine the huge scandal that has rocked the Los Angeles City Council in the wake of leaked recordings between several council members using racist and violent language. My guest, Ulysses Hernandez, is a well-known progressive activist who beat one of the incumbents in question this past June and takes her seat later this year. Finally, award-winning journalist Joshua Frank, co-editor of Counterpunch, joins me to discuss his new book, Atomic Days, the untold story of the most toxic place in America. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Son Ali, and I'm your host, Son Ali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A fiery debate on Monday between Ohio's candidates vying for a Senate seat symbolizes a major political dynamic across the country as we head toward the November 8th midterm elections. Democrat Tim Ryan, who currently serves as a House representative, sparred with Trump-backed Republican candidate J.D. Vance, who's never held office. Although Donald Trump is no longer president, his influence within the GOP remains strong, and the elections are a test of the party's gambit to embrace extremism. Both the Senate and the House are in play, with the Democrats holding on to razor-thin majorities right now. Political pundits are reminding us that the party that loses the presidency usually gains seats in the midterm elections. But the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, in spite of abortion rights remaining popular, is a stark reminder of what Republican control has delivered. We turn to Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, a contributing editor at The Baffler and The New Republic, where he was formerly the editor of both publications. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So first, what did Monday night's debate between Ryan and Vance symbolize? Did it, as I mentioned, showcase this dynamic between Democrats and Trump-backed Republicans that are really proxy elections, if you will, for Trump and Trumpism?
Yes, well, Donald Trump is very much on the ballot, which is how Donald Trump likes it. Yeah, the makeover of J.D. Vance, you know, just a little bit of background here. Just prior to the 2016 election, he published his celebrated best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. He was then promptly anointed as a sort of mystic interlocutor of the white working class that everyone was hearing about after the 2016 election, kind of shocked the political establishment in America. And he was a vocal never Trumper. He, you know, claimed that Trump was accurately so, you know, a vicious bigot and a xenophobe and did not reflect, you know, the better angels of Americans' civic culture. And now the J.D. Vance we are seeing, you know, running for Senate in Ohio is a full bore mini Trump. He, as Trump joked at a rally in Youngstown, you know, J.D. Vance has been kissing Trump's ass to get his support. And Peter Thiel, one of the major funders of the GOP, has kicked in $15 million to Vance's candidacy. He has very much remade himself in the image of Trumpian politics. And we saw that in the debate last night. He went really hard after what he claimed is, you know, the open border, claiming that it has, you know, bred all kinds of social ills, from rampant fentanyl deaths in Ohio to the tragic case involving the 10-year-old who was raped and needed to go out of state to get an abortion. So it is a playbook of just hammering at these same issues of, you know, kind of white grievance and fear-based politics, and just demagoguing your way in a very blatant and, you know, in my view, amoral fashion. And, you know, that what's distressing is it seems to be working for Vance. So the race is lately tightened in his favor. I didn't see anything in the debate, though I thought Tim Ryan did acquit himself creditably in the debate. Vance was clearly primed to go hard and hard right on all the issues under discussion. And I think I hate judging events in this sort of thumbs up, thumbs down way, but if I were forced to do so, I don't believe that Ryan, you know, did anything to stall Vance's momentum in the race.
So this, you know, this is Ohio. It went hard for Trump in 2020 and 2016, and it was considered a safe Republican seat, but then with Vance being the Republican nominee for that seat, Republicans, sort of centrist Republicans, worried that by putting an extremist candidate forward, they might potentially lose a safe seat. But you're saying that Vance is giving Ryan a run for his money, which suggests that maybe this gambit to embrace Trumpism might work for the GOP.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing a lot of candidates. I just read a long profile of Carrie Lake, the governor, gubernatorial candidate in Arizona, who's very much like, you know, the Southwestern version of J.D. Vance. She is a political novice. She is super media savvy. She actually records all her exchanges with reporters so that, you know, they can send out, you know, press releases alleging, you know, fake news from any interview that emerges. You're seeing this whole next generation of ambitious political leaders on the American right who are taking the, you know, the Trump model as their blueprint. And, you know, I think in part because, you know, it's depressingly hard to get anyone to turn out in midterm cycles. So the group of people voting tends to be more extreme on both sides. And, you know, there is genuine anxiety about the direction of the economy and inflation. And the Democrats have sort of found their messaging has been scrambled a lot by that. So that creates a climate where this kind of dishonest, fear-based politics can really thrive, just as it did in 2016.
The New York Times did an interesting poll of voters recently and found that there were, you know, far too many Republicans who believed that the 2020 election was stolen and were likely to back candidates who also openly espoused this idea that the 2020 election was stolen. And it's interesting, though, when confronted by Democrats in debates about this, often Republican candidates tend to back down and assert what everybody knows and is well documented, that the election wasn't stolen. There's this tacit understanding that the January 6th riots were somehow legitimized, in Washington, D.C., were somehow a legitimate reflection of you know, anger over a stolen election. There's just so much sleight of hand that relies on misinformation in this election that suggests that our democracy might be weaker than ever. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the absolute low points in the Vance Ryan debate was, you know, the panel tried to pin Vance down. You know, the kind of quid pro quo, it's been reported for Vance getting Trump support was Vance had to kind of sign off on the big lie about the 2020 election. And when he was pressed on this by the debate panel, Vance delivered this, you know, it did kind of make my jaw drop. He said, you know, obviously the events of January 6th were tragic, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there was a failure to honor the outcome of the 2016 election, referring, of course, to the Mueller investigation and allegations of Russian collusion. That was as bad as January 6th. And, you know, at that point, you just want to, you know, you want an adult in the room to, you know, say, you cannot say this kind of thing. It is, you know, it is a far, you know, I'm becoming inarticulate just describing it. It is so enraging that kind of, and that is, you know, now standard stump rhetoric across the Republican Party. So yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the question of our democracy in peril, because that is another, you know, there was a Times poll released today saying that voters agree that democracy is in jeopardy and yet it is not one of their priorities. And I see that, you know, I mean, I will, you know, freely concede for structural reasons, I'm rooting hard for a Democratic takeover of, or a retaining power in both houses of Congress. But I do see that poll is evidence of a failure in messaging on the Democrats' part. You know,
right, and that was my next question. It shouldn't be that difficult to counter such blatant misinformation with adherence to justice, fairness, truth, facts.
Right. Or, you know, the actual traditions, yeah. You know, the better angels of this country, you know. we want this to be a democracy of one person, one vote. We want maximum participation in the system. We want, you know, we don't want voter suppression based on race or access to wealth or anything else. And yeah, I haven't seen that message, you know, tied together in a really compelling way. I know it's difficult in many ways to say the democracy is in peril in 30-second sound bites. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this is a crisis and you don't get really to choose how you message around it. It is actually the case that if, you know, enough election deniers get governorships and secretary of state positions in this cycle, you know, it just will take two or three swing states in 2024. If Trump runs again and doesn't get the popular vote, doesn't carry the appropriate swing states, these state officials could well, you know, block the election results.
So the Senate,
you would have January 6th in the state houses of swing states.
So let's talk about the Senate and the dynamics. So currently, Democrats hold exactly 50 seats. And because they control the presidency, they can, Vice President Kamala Harris has been a tie-breaking vote. And so they cannot afford to lose even a single seat in order to lose control of the Senate. But there are more Republican Senate seats in play, as far as I understand, then what is the outcome that you expect? How close could this be? Because all it's going to take is a handful of seats going this way or that way to flip control of the Senate.
Well, I got out of the prediction business after the 2016 election. But it is very tight. And, you know, races that the Democratic Senate caucus had been sort of banking as relatively safe are now up in the air. The Warnock Walker race in Georgia and the Nevada race are both much too close to call. And, you know, the worry is that, you know, concerns about inflation and the economy are coming to predominate. And that, again, is an area where Democratic messaging is not really
I'm glad you brought up the Walker race with Warnock. I mean, Raphael Warnock is a very strong candidate. Herschel Walker didn't even show up to the debate. I mean, aside from the controversy around the fact that it now seems as though he almost definitely paid for the abortion of an ex-girlfriend while publicly opposing abortion, he didn't even show up to debate Raphael Warnock. And yet, he is a competitive candidate?
I don't know Georgia politics at close remove, but it is the case in a lot of states, especially in the South, that voter suppression plays a very big role. It famously played a role in Stacey Abrams not winning in her first run for governor. I'm assuming that, you know, you're seeing a motivated base of GOP extremists and perhaps a less motivated or a diminishing level of motivation among the Democratic base. So what happens in midterms where you have low turnout across the board?
Right. And that's a huge challenge this year. Let's talk about the House. If you have any sense of the House, it ends up being in the last few races, at least, that Democratic candidates end up getting more votes and fewer seats. And we see the effects of gerrymandering in districts across the country. Do you expect something similar to happen in combination with low voter turnout?
Yeah, the House, I don't think, has ever been seriously in play for the Democrats, and less so now. So again, I'm not predicting, you know, things can still happen between now and the election, but yes, because so many House seats are drawn to guarantee incumbency and are drawn to favor, you know, most state houses or state legislatures are controlled by Republicans, and they draw the electoral maps, and they tend, not surprisingly, to favor Republican candidates. I would be very surprised if the Democrats manage to take the House. It is still possible.
To keep the House. I mean, they have the House right now.
Keep the House, right. Yes,
so what about the fact that the overturning of abortion rights has been, you know, something that almost cynically you've seen the Democrats use it as a way to get voters out. President Biden has said that Democrats will move to codify Roe, which is now overturned, into law, codify abortion rights into law. Democrats had some chances to do that over the past couple of decades, didn't do it. Anyway, now they're using it as a way to get voters to the poll. And there was some sense after the Supreme Court overturned the right to an abortion that maybe this would show voters just how dangerous Republicans are when they can control Congress.
Yeah, and I think that is still, obviously, it's an urgent and compelling issue, and the Democrats are definitely right to run hard on it. But I think, again, it's the case when these other sort of, you know, kitchen table kind of issues like the state of the economy loom larger, rightly or wrongly, there's a perception that, which I think is utterly mistaken, abortion access is an economic issue. If you're coercing people into motherhood, you're dramatically curtailing their life chances and their ability to participate in the economy. That is just true. But you don't, you know, I think, again, the Democratic messaging has largely been about individual rights and the threat that Republican control of Congress, and it's a real threat, posed to the access to reproductive freedom. But I think, you know, you also have to make it a case that's more than grounded in an individualist model of politics. And I think, again, that's where the messaging I've been seeing in congressional races doesn't really connect those dots.
Right. You've written about the Supreme Court, which of course is, you know, the way it is right now, courtesy of Trump and the Republicans, Mitch McConnell in particular, bending rules to ensure that we now have a conservative supermajority on the court. And you also mentioned earlier the issue of voting rights is a big case that has been in play in the Supreme Court. How has the Supreme Court in its current configuration ensured Republican minority rule, or will continue to ensure Republican minority rule?
Well, you know, in a very flagrant way. I mean, I think it's important always to remember that John Roberts was a voting rights attorney under the Reagan administration, and his mission was to suppress voting rights. That has been, you know, a formative influence in his career, and he sees this issue in a very sort of quasi-partisan, ahistorical way. This is why it's so frustrating when people, you know, kind of say that the Supreme Court has to be above politics somehow. These are all, you know, Brett Kavanaugh was a career Republican flack, and same for Amy Coney Barrett. An interesting factoid is that Roberts, Coney Barrett, and Kavanaugh were, or I'm sorry, Neil Gorsuch, were all down in the 2000 Brooks Brothers riot, when in Florida, when the outcome of the 2000 presidential election was up for grabs, they were manning the legal team for the Bush campaign. So to sort of, you know, make believe and close your eyes all of a sudden that these same people are these Olympian characters who can stand above the fray and pronounce the way things should be is a ludicrous claim. And we're seeing now it is an ideological hard right court with, as you say, an ironclad 6-3 majority. So yeah, there's this awful voting rights case up before the court this term that will essentially say if it's decided in the favor of, and it propounds this theory of the independent legislature that can basically determine the outcome of a presidential balloting under its own steam. And again, that would unleash a kind of state by state wave of, you know, what Trump wanted in 2020, negating valid election results and just putting up your own pet candidates. It is an appalling thing, and it could very well happen. And if that happens in conjunction, as I said, with these election denying governors and secretaries of state, we are looking at, you know, the idea of democracy in peril is not just rhetoric. We will stop being a functioning democracy at that point.
I want to thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today. We'll post a link to your articles in The Nation from our website. Thanks and good luck to you.
Great. Thank you very much.
My guest has been Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, a contributing editor at the BAFRA and The New Republic, where he was formerly the editor of both publications. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Los Angeles has been roiled by scandal of national proportions over the past week, centered on a leaked audio recording of a meeting last year between three city council members and Ron Herrera, president of the LA County Federation of Labor. Nuri Martinez, then president of the LA City Council, was chief among those who used disparaging and racist remarks about the adopted black son of fellow council member Mike Bonin. While Martinez and Herrera have both resigned from their positions, two other city council members, Kevin De Leon and Gil Cedillo, as of this recording, remain in their seats. They have, however, both been stripped of their committee assignments. We turn now to Councilmember-elect Ulysses Hernandez, who won the seat occupied by Councilmember Gil Cedillo this past June. Welcome to the program, Ulysses.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So this has been a very trying time for Los Angeles. You ran on a progressive platform and you take your seat in December. Congratulations on winning your seat. And I don't suppose you expected to take your position just months from a scandal that has provoked even President Joe Biden to call for resignations of the city council members in question. What have the recent city council meetings been like? You've attended them since the recording first came to light. Protesters have been attending them, demanding resignations. There's been a lot of pain caused by the recording. Give me a sense of what those meetings have been like since it all came to light.
Well, the meetings, you know, the first meeting since the conversation came to light was intense. You know, City Hall was full of community members. But I think the most shocking part was when Councilmember Cedillo and Kevin De Leon showed up to the meeting. Community was outraged. You could feel the tension in the room. And also you could feel that the council didn't have power over the pushback that was happening. And I think that's kind of the same pattern that we're in today where, you know, they canceled the last few meetings. The meetings for this week have been canceled at least until, you know, the midweek. And so we're going to see what's going to happen. But community does not want to move forward as with business as usual until these two people resign or until the city council takes steps to remove them from their positions.
Let's get a sense of what was being discussed. There's sort of two broadly speaking issues here. One is that the council members in question used very racist remarks, not just to Mike Bonin's son, but also to the Oaxacan community in East Los Angeles. And then, so there was the racism. And then all of this was happening in the context of discussions around redistricting that have sought to try to maximize the power of one community over another. So give me a sense. So the racism, we know that there is racism. We know there's anti-blackness. We know there's anti-indigenous sentiment. But give us, explain for our audience what the redistricting conversation was around.
So the redistricting conversation was about how to maintain the power of the three council members that were in that space to make sure that the drawing of the maps benefited them for their election. And the incumbent that I ran against, there was a conversation, particularly in that set of hour, where they were talking about how he needed to cut out certain parts of the district, parts of the north side of the district, which he said were headaches for him. And when you look at the map now of the election results, I won that entire north district, and so it's reflective of what he wanted to do, which is cut it up. This redistricting conversation is really important because it happens every 10 years. It's based on the census. It's one of the opportunities where communities of color, particularly Black communities, have the power to really uplift leadership in that space. And what we saw was that three people out of the 15 council membership were plotting and deciding how they wanted the maps to look so that it most benefited them and their legacy and to make sure that they got elected. Usually redistricting is about how we can create more representation for our communities, but that's not what the conversation was about. It was about holding power amongst three people and someone was the president of the Labor Federation.
Ron Herrera, right?
Yeah, Ron Herrera. this conversation, I also want to uplift that it wasn't just a conversation that included racism, anti-LGBTQ sentiment, anti-Indigenous indigenous sentiment, and not only about maintaining their power, but it was also a reflection of how politics have been working at City Hall, because it wasn't just a conversation, it had real life implications. They talked about destroying Councilmember Nithya's Raman's district, which they have done, they have broken apart. They talked about putting in someone in CD10 who would benefit, you know, the policies and the direction that they wanted to move forward with. And we saw that the person that they uplifted in that space was appointed. So I think that's something really critical to also address. Like, it wasn't just a conversation. It wasn't just highlighting. This had real life implications on the lives of the over 4 million Angelenos that live in Los Angeles.
So multiple things were revealed. When we talk about secret backroom deals, this is the definition of that. Let's talk for a moment about how the community has come together, the anti-blackness in particular, that Nuri Martinez and De Leon and others demonstrated towards Mike Bonin's son. Mike Bonin, for those who are outside of Los Angeles, he's a white city council member. He has an adopted son who's black. And Nuri Martinez talked about his boy in violent and racist terms. How have Latino residents rallied around the black community saying we don't stand for this. This doesn't represent us.
What we're seeing is a beautiful collective building on the community level. And I think I just want to frame that at the community level, for years, people have been working to build bridges, to build coalition between Black, Brown, Indigenous, and LGBTQ communities. This was just something that spurred even deeper relationship building, where you have organizations and communities such as the community of Oaxacan standing with the community of Black Lives Matter, protesting outside of City Hall, calling for the resignation of these three individuals. And so, you know, it's a stain on City Council what has happened, but this is really uplifted and cemented the relationships that have been building for years on the community level. There's plenty of beautiful videos and pictures of, you know, folks coming together, especially outside of City Hall, inside of City Hall, moving towards the direction of, you know, they do not represent us. We need to actually fight for people who are going to represent our values in our community.
How did the discussion center around redistricting with respect to Black communities and Latino communities? There were statements made, oh, he's with the Blacks, or he's with the Oaxacans, or they're with the Oaxacans, etc. How did that come across, and how do you make sense of that to a non-LA audience?
You know, Los Angeles is one of the most beautifully diverse places in the entire country. We have communities that, you know, are disproportionately impacted by systemic issues, predominantly Black, Brown, Latino, and Indigenous communities. And so this conversation around, oh, I'm with a certain group, or I'm with a certain group, we have to protect our group. It's a really immature analysis of the systemic issues that are actually impacting our city. And it's an immature analysis on what representation should look like. You know, Latinos are 50% of the population in the city of LA does not mean that we need to be 50% of the city council. If we're really talking about equity, if we're really talking about uplifting communities that are most disproportionately impacted by these systemic issues, then that's what the council should reflect. And their conversation was not that, it was antithetical to that. It was, how do we keep our power and how do we put people in these seats that are gonna do what we say? Which is very much different than actually doing a process around equity, making sure that Black communities have the necessary representation, that we have folks who are trans, gender nonconforming on the council, that's more diverse than just, you know, the Latino community, which, you know, I come from the Latino community. I've seen, you know, the anti-Blackness, the racism in my community, but I've worked for years to move people in a better direction, and we're moving that in that direction. But if we're really talking about equity and representation and not leaving people behind, then, you know, we have to move forward with different representation on the council, because what has happened and the conversations that occurred really have put us in a place where we have left communities behind, particularly Black communities and Indigenous communities.
With respect to the Indigenous community, she referred to Oaxacans in Koreatown, and this is Nuri Martinez, who has now resigned, she referred to them. in very disparaging terms as well. I won't repeat it. People can certainly see the transcripts of the recordings. The LA Times has published them. This is a very rich community, culturally rich community. It has created so much beauty in Los Angeles through its culture. How are people, how can Angelenos responding in particular? Because again, this is something that if you're not from LA, you may not know very much about this community.
Yes. So, I mean, I think for me throughout this whole process, seeing how the Oaxacan community has stood up for themselves is one of the most, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, is one of the most beautiful things I've seen to come out of this mess. They have held marches and rallies leading up to City Hall. They have taken the place outside of City Hall and danced and put music and were dressed in their indigenous attire. You know, all of this was a reflection of their power, you know, calling for the resignation of these individuals who have disparaged them. You know, folks don't really think that there's a large Oaxacan community. If you're not from LA, you're not gonna know that LA is one of the places where we have one of the largest populations of the Oaxacan community next to Mexico. And so to see them standing in their power, to see them demanding what they deserve is incredibly beautiful, especially when they were disparaged so horribly on these conversations by all the members in that call. The incumbent Gil Cedillo disparaged them, what they look like. And so, I mean, I think for folks that don't know, they should definitely look into it. It's the Oaxacan culture and community here is has one of the most beautiful reflections in both the where they work, how they run a lot of our restaurants, and even that the food that they produce. I know that they're very proud of that. And so I hope folks can tap into that, because it's, I think, one of the most beautiful things to come out of this mess.
The members of the city council at stake, and Ron Herrera, who has also now resigned from his position at the LA County Federation of Labor, these are not right-wingers, right? These are supposed to be part of the sort of liberal faction of politics. On the one hand, it sounds shocking to hear how they talk when they think no one's listening. But on the other hand, I imagine for folks like you who've been working as an outsider insider, if you will, soon to be insider, it's not surprising, right, that even liberal politicians, or perhaps especially liberal politicians, use identity politics to serve their ends outside and then internally use it in a very cynical way and racist way.
Yes, in particular, you know, the incumbent that I ran against, Gil Cedillo, was endorsed by Bernie Sanders. Mm. He was endorsed by a lot of the Democratic establishment, a lot of the unions that represent these very same communities that he's disparaged. And so when we talk about liberals, when we talk about progressives, it means nothing if they don't have values and they're not connected to community. When you look at who funds their campaigns, that's a big deal. The incumbent that I ran against took hundreds of thousands of dollars from developers, real estate, different corporations. Our campaign, we rejected all of that money. And when we did get donations from them, we refunded that money because we're not accountable to these corporations and to these entities, special interest groups. We are only accountable to community. And so I think when folks think about progressives and liberals, it's more than just how they speak. It's where their money comes from. It's what their values are. And I wouldn't even say who endorses them, because even that process is full of issues, as we saw with Bernie endorsing Gil Cedillo, Bernie Sanders.
Right. Ulysses, you tell me also about the work that you and other progressive Latino activists have done in finding common cause and building bridges with the Black community. You ran on a platform of completely reimagining the carceral state. You know, Los Angeles and LAPD and LA County Sheriff's Department are notorious for the violence that they use, and LA, you know, Men's Central Jail in downtown LA, and all of those systems of incarceration that you've taken on are also the targets of our local Black Lives Matter chapter in Los Angeles. So tell me about that important work, the cross-cultural work, cross-racial work that you have been engaged in.
That's a great question. And when it comes to working on campaigns, when it comes to working on policies, most of my work has been around the criminal justice system. But it's because it's this system and other systemic failures, because they disproportionately impact Black, Brown, Indigenous, and low-income communities, LGBTQ communities, is why we are so intentional in making sure that when we do move forward with our work, that the tables that we build are reflective of the communities that are most disproportionately impacted, that we take the lead from people that are directly impacted. And so for me, it's critically important that our coalitions, our values, and how we move forward is reflected of building bridges and of uplifting the communities that are most disproportionately impacted. When we talk about the carceral system in LA County, 50% of the people in the jail system are Latino. 30% of the people in the jail system are Black. Yet Black community members only make up 9% of the LA County's general population. And so the system that is sucking up the Latino community is being reinforced and used also on our Black community members, on our LGBTQ community members. And so that's why it's important when we're doing analysis, when you're thinking about how to move forward, that you take all of these things into consideration, because it's not just the Latino community that's most impacted. We have other communities that are being sucked in and impacted by these different systems. So for me, it's like when we worked on Measure J, which moved 10% of locally generated tax dollars back into community, we included in there to make sure that money could go specifically to Black and minority-owned businesses. When we worked on the jail fight to stop LA County's $3.5 billion jail contract, we uplifted the disproportionate impacts that the carceral system has on Black women in particular, and particularly Black trans women. During COVID-19, when people were being released out of the jail, Black trans women were the group that was least released compared to everybody else, and Black women. And so that's why it's important that when people are doing the work, that they have this analysis. And that's why the conversation that happened in that room, I feel like it's very immature, it's very unsophisticated, and you know, it's not built for success, it's not built to bring everybody together. So that's why on the community level, we've been very intentional about that, because in other campaigns, in other policies, we've left, but communities have been left behind, and we haven't gone back for those communities. They have not been able to benefit from reforms or different law changes.
Nasiz, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you as you get ready to take your seat on the City Council. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Los Angeles City Council member-elect Eunices Hernandez, who won the seat occupied by Councilmember Gil Cedillo this past June. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A new book by journalist Joshua Frank tells the story of one of the world's major nuclear waste sites, a place right here in the United States that most of you have likely never heard of. Hanford Nuclear Site in Washington State was, in Frank's words, quote, home to the U.S. government's gargantuan plutonium operation. It, quote, churned out nearly all of the radioactive fuel that was used in the country's nuclear arsenal. Although no longer active, it remains the costliest environmental remediation project the world has ever seen, and arguably the most contaminated place on the entire planet. Joshua Frank is an award-winning journalist, co-editor of the news site Counterpunch, author of several books, including The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink. He joins me to discuss his new book, Atomic Days, The Untold Story of the Most Toxic Place in America. Welcome to the program, Joshua.
Thanks for having me back on. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. I had never heard of Hanford, Washington, and as you mentioned, probably most Americans have never heard of it either. Tell me the story of how you stumbled upon this particular site that's in, you know, it's several hours away from Seattle in Washington. How did it all start?
I went to college in Oregon, and I think people within the environmental community in the Northwest are aware of Hanford, or at least tangentially, they know Hanford exists. They kind of understand a little bit about it. But even people in the Northwest really don't know the peril that it's in. Hanford was chosen as a site during the Manhattan Project in the 1940s. And it was chosen because it's very remote at the time. It's, you know, in Eastern Washington. It was along the Columbia River. It had access to constant electricity because of the dams. So it was sort of like out of sight, out of mind. And of course, we know how covert the Manhattan Project was. So a lot of people even in and around the area didn't have any idea of what was going on there. The B reactor was the first reactor built that produced plutonium. And it was the first full-scale plutonium plant in the entire world, the fuel of which was used in the Fat Man bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. And then over the course of the next decades during the Cold War, like you said, it produced a gargantuan amount of plutonium. And now we're suffering with the waste that came from that nuclear production. Plutonium is a byproduct of the nuclear process. And there's a ton of waste out there, so much waste that it's hard to even comprehend. There are 177 underground tanks that hold 56 million gallons of radioactive bubbling waste. And those tanks that are just a few feet below the surface of the ground are only a few miles away from the Columbia River. And those tanks were only built to hold that waste for about 20 years in some cases. So we're looking at going on 80 years. And so it's a big problem. There's been many, many leaks. There's been near catastrophes. And taxpayers in the US are paying so much money to clean this place up, and not much progress has been made. The current totals are about $677 billion. And that number just keeps going up. It was only about half that much 5 years ago. So, I want to bring a little attention to how bad this issue is. The contractors that are tasked with cleaning it up have a very shoddy track record, Bechtel being the prime suspect. And the Department of Energy just doesn't have the staff to oversee it. So, yeah, I really dive into a lot of these issues. And I hope it's a wake-up call about nuclear technology in general, but also the cleanup process that's going on out there.
Tell me about the workers and some of whom you talk to who are tasked with keeping this place, cleaned up or ensuring that it doesn't contaminate any more than it is. What sort of conditions do they work under? What have they suffered?
Yeah, well, I've had a couple whistleblowers go on record. I write about them in the book. And I wrote pieces for Seattle Weekly a number of years ago about a couple in particular. One, Donald Alexander, who is a top-level, now retired, DOE scientist. And what he said was absolutely startling to me. He talked about how the DOE is understaffed. This Department of Energy doesn't have enough technical staff to manage the project. And they are under extreme, working conditions. The workers that are on the ground obviously are working in some of the most toxic environments that are in, anywhere. They're exposed to toxic vapors, chemical vapors. They're working with nuclear waste in a lot of cases. But it's not just nuclear waste. There's also all kinds of other, toxic elements all over the place out there. And so I write about a number of people that have been, exposed that are now fighting back for more worker protections. And sadly, the unions haven't come together to really protect these workers. And there's been a history of malfeasance with the unions out there. But this isn't to say that, you know, everybody out there is ill-intentioned. That's not the case at all. But you're operating under a for-profit environment, you know, workers' safety is secondary. Another whistleblower that I talked to, Walter Tamasitis, who has just an excruciating story that I write about. He was a contractor for URS, which was a subcontractor of Bechtel. And he talks about just how management out there is more concerned about the bottom line than with cleaning up Hanford. And you know, we're seeing the damage that that's done. I mean, we've seen that nothing's really happened yet out there cleaning this stuff up, and it's costing us a lot of money. So, you know, workers are expendable, and so are taxpayers.
This land, like land all over what we call the United States today, is indigenous land. So tell me about the original inhabitants of the land that has now been laid waste by these nuclear byproducts of plutonium mining, and what role they play today.
Yeah, well, you know, the Columbia River has long been the lifeblood for the entire Northwest, going back tens of thousands of years. It was, you know, the all the salmon that were coming up that people lived off of for generations. When Lewis and Clark came into the Columbia River Basin, you know, they talked about how salmon runs were so great they could walk across the backs of them to get to the other side of the river. I mean, it was a plentiful river, a vibrant river. Just downstream from Hanford, there was a meeting place where indigenous communities all over the West Coast would gather for trading. So there's a long history there. Most recently with the Hanford project, the Yakima Nation has been integrally involved. They were originally removed, so were the Nez Perce from this area, to erect this atomic beast. And the Yakima Nation, under the guidance of Russell Jim, who died a few years ago, Russell Jim was an elder who dedicated his life to representing his people in the fight to clean up Hanford, and made a tremendous impact. I write about him as well, because I think, you know, it's easy to get really doom and gloom when you're talking about nuclear waste and the potential for the disaster. But it's also important to talk about the people that are making, you know, progress. And the Yakima and indigenous communities now have a voice, and there's no federal legislation or anything that can happen at Hanford without a seat at the table for them. And that's thanks to the work that he did. So, you know, it's historically, just like much of this, the military apparatus of the United States, indigenous peoples, poor people, working people are expendable people. They are easily removed. They're easily forgotten, because the U.S. military machine is more important. And of course, during the Cold War, we know that the U.S. would go to any lengths to, you know, counter what they thought was, you know, a Russian offensive.
Joshua, what is the big danger right now with Hanford nuclear waste site? What do you fear? Having done the research and written this book, what do you fear, and what do we all need to fear could happen if action isn't taken? And also, what action does need to be taken?
Well, right now, the most pressing concern, in my view, is that these tanks are leaking. There's a tank that's leaking right now that they don't really know what to do with. They're letting it leak.
Is it leaking into the river?
It's leaking into the groundwater supplies that will eventually make its way to the river, yes. Wow. I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow there's another leak that's found. There's been something almost 70 leaks that have been on record in the last, you know, since it's been in operation. So that's a big concern, obviously. But from a even a more dire situation, like Donald Alexander talked about with me, if there's a hydrogen buildup in one of these tanks, there could be an atomic explosion that could happen. And a similar thing actually happened at a sister facility that a lot of people don't know about in the 50s in Russia, at the place called Mayak, which a explosion happened there and completely decimated an entire region of people. Of course, that was really never talked about because that was also a covert operation. And the U.S. didn't want to expose it either because it would, it would, you know, probably cause a little concern about our own nuclear proliferation. But that potential is very real at Hanford. And if that kind of thing were to happen, it would decimate the economy of the Northwest, not to mention the environment. Places like Boise would become uninhabitable. And this is a very real concern. And, you know, this nuclear waste, if it doesn't become vitrified, which is what they're planning on doing, which is turning it into glass and safely storing it, we could be facing this problem going down the road here. And you know, it might not happen for 50 years, but that's nothing in you know, lifespan of nuclear waste. So this waste is going to be bubbling for the next 200,000 years. So it's a big concern, and I think it's a cautionary tale of nuclear waste in general. And nuclear power production produces waste, and the same kind of issues exist with all nuclear technology. So what can we do? There's a lot of groups.
One point, when you say all nuclear technology, currently in the wake of you know, communities looking for solutions to climate change, nuclear is often touted as a clean energy. Does Hanford hold any lessons for that? Even though, of course, the plutonium mined from Hanford was for nuclear weaponry.
Yeah. Well, I think it's without getting too technical about the science, in order to produce plutonium, you have to have a nuclear reaction and a nuclear reactor. There was 9 nuclear reactors at Hanford. Instead of producing nuclear energy, you know, it was producing plutonium. Plutonium's a byproduct, just like CO2 is a byproduct of burning fossil fuels. So in a power plant, nuclear power plants that operate today, they also produce plutonium and nuclear waste. That plutonium has a 250,000 year lifespan. So you have to be able to, you have to put that somewhere safely and store it indefinitely, right? So it's still a problem. Obviously, they've come a long way in dealing with nuclear waste, but there's no way to keep nuclear waste safe for that long of a period of time. I mean, to put it in perspective, humans have only been roaming the Earth for 60,000 years or so, right? So what are you going to do for 100,000 years? And aside from the problem of nuclear waste, what it could do, or plutonium in particular, due to the environment, it also can be used in nuclear weapons. So governments have a reason to keep this stuff safe. And how are you going to do that over that long period of time? So I think it's really important that people are concerned about it. And definitely Hanford poses some lessons for us there. And then really quickly on nuclear power too, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but the mining of uranium is very carbon intensive. To extract uranium it takes a lot of fossil fuels to do that. So it's definitely not a green energy. And I would argue one of the most dangerous energy sources we have today.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Joshua, for joining us today. I appreciate your time. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Joshua Frank, award-winning journalist, co-editor of the news site Counterpunch. And we've been discussing his new book, Atomic Days, The Untold Story of the Most Toxic Place in America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters, RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files. Thank you.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness.